the journey to leadership is anything but conventional. Join Justin Gray as he talks with badass leaders from across the globe to discover where they came from and the drive that got them to where they are today. Welcome. This is Driven & Co.
So hello and welcome again. This is Justin Gray, CEO, LeadMD, Six Bricks. I've invited our new COO, David Bauer, to join us here on the podcast. And a little bit of a break from our normal guest profile, but really interesting story to where David, how David got to where he is today, and some really great work-life balance stuff to share as well. So David, welcome to the show.
Hey, I'm very glad to be here. I'm glad to be with the company and glad to be doing this with you.
Absolutely. So, you know, as I normally do on these podcasts, why don't you give us a little bit of a snapshot of your position, your role with LeadMD, what a day-to-day looks like. I'd love to just kind of give people a level set on what your responsibilities at in your current role entail.
Great, thanks. Well, as Chief Operations Officer, I think my role here is really to set the standard for what we're expecting from our people and to set a leadership style so that people can grow in their current positions and feel like they have something to base on expectations on, to base how they're going to run their business. I've had a lot of experience in the past in consulting, and I think I'm trying to bring some kind of predictability and expectations to people on how they're going to grow in their careers and know what is expected and what's not expected. My background's not as much in marketing as it is in just growing businesses, using people, process, and technology to make companies bigger. And there's such a great opportunity here with the staff, and trying to get them to that next level is really what I think it's all about. So right now it's putting people in the right places and making sure people are growing in the areas that they want to grow in. I've always believed that people do better doing what they like to do. And this idea of working on your weaknesses is not something that I really adhere to. So trying to find the right places for people and making sure they feel great in doing their work is what I'm trying to do right now.
Awesome. And so, as I mentioned, David has a really interesting, diverse background in kind of his career path and so on. But before we get into that, let's zoom all the way back in the Wayback Machine. And David, what did you want to be when you grew up, when you were a kid?
Well, I guess, my first earliest memories were going to the back of a McDonald's, going in through the back entrance. We had a family friend who owned a McDonald's franchise in my hometown, and he took me in the back. And when I saw the workings of a restaurant, I just fell in love. And we had a Kilpatrick's Bakery around town that you could smell the bread being baked when you were driving by. And he took us into the factory, and we bought his Big Mac bread and just how it was sliced up, and just really understanding the restaurant business and working in that business just seemed like such a dream for me. And it was something that I always felt like I wanted to do, was to be in the restaurant business and to run my own restaurant. And when I met my girlfriend, who became my wife, she had actually the same dream. And it was one of those few things that I can actually say that my dream when I was a kid came true. We owned and managed two restaurants for about 9 years. So very successful Italian restaurant business, and really had a great time. It was exactly what I thought it was going to be, a lot of hard work, but something that just allowed us to be creative and entrepreneurial. And it was just kind of what I thought it was going to be. So it was a really great run.
Yeah, I wasn't sure where that story was going when you said, your earliest dreams began in the back of a McDonald's. That could go a lot of different ways, but that's...
Yeah. Going in that back door, well, anybody who's into the restaurant business, the back door is the kind of the more important than the front door. Totally. And you're right. It's kind of a weird concept. The back of businesses is always kind of what's interested me. And because I like the way to see how things run. And it just seeing that first French fry machine, peeling real potatoes. And I can still remember that. I was probably like 6 or 7 years old. And it was just something that always stuck with me.
That's awesome. So, but you didn't, go directly from, adolescence and schooling and so on into the restaurant business. You kind of had a little bit of a detour through Accenture, correct?
Well, what happened was, it was never going to be one of those things that my wife and I could do in the same room. We learned very early that we had two very strong personalities, and someone needed to make sure that the money was coming in. And even getting that restaurant business, I was working at Accenture, and she was actually in school, and she wanted to compete for the San Francisco State pizza kind of monopoly on campus. And she, because we had that dream, she said, look, if you build me the business model, I'll run the business. And so I put together the business plan, and she actually won over 25 other restaurants to have the ability to run that monopoly for 5 years. So I was actually at Accenture when she really actually ran the business. I was more the financier and did all the back office stuff. But yeah, that happened during that time. When I got out of college, it was not one of those things where I went right into the restaurant business. You're right. I went right to Accenture when I got out of school.
So do you think that experience at Accenture, again, just kind of diving in from a consulting standpoint on a bunch of different businesses, is that what kind of gave you the confidence and the fortitude and the knowledge to start a business like that? Or is that more innate?
I think that's more innate. You either want to take that risk and want to bet on yourself, or you don't. I think going to Accenture was really the kind of more like my dad's kind of decision. He was a doctor, and he was going to a profession. And it wasn't one of those things where you did things like that where I grew up. You didn't go in and take chances like that. You kind of went the traditional route, and I got an MBA. And then I saw accounting as just something I couldn't do. And so even when I was being recruited by what was then Arthur Andersen and Company, it wasn't something where I wanted to go into accounting. It had to be something like consulting where I could really learn a new craft. But I always kind of had that entrepreneurial sense to me. And I could actually, it could be realized, I think, a little bit more through my wife and myself doing it together than it could be just me alone. Because I needed to earn money, and I needed to be that kind of breadwinner. And, the restaurant business is a very risky business. We knew going in it was going to be a very risky business. So, and we both wanted to make sure we lived well. So I think having one of us kind of take that safe route and one of us take that kind of more risky route worked very well for us as a couple.
And so, like, ultimately, what happened to the pizza joint? You mentioned that you had kind of a monopoly, and I believe it's UC Davis, correct? Or UC San Diego?
It was actually... That one was at San Francisco State.
Okay.
I was working at Accenture in San Francisco, and she was finishing her education in San Francisco State. She had followed me to New York for a couple of years, and she was helping some other people run some businesses and so some restaurants. And so when we came back, she just needed to get her degree and finish up. And she was finishing up at San Francisco State, that was doing so well, we opened up a second restaurant that was just a traditional 364 day a year business. And we had our first child, and that went great. We kept the restaurant, everything was going great. But then she got pregnant with twins. And when all of a sudden you got twins coming, and you got one already, and I don't know, and my business was actually going really well, I think we just decided, I think we got to sell. So she sold out, made a nice little fortune that she put into a kitchen remodel, as it turned out, and our restaurant fund turned into a kitchen remodel, 5 years later, when she decided, okay, I'm not going to go back into that. Cause it's a labor of love, but it's a long day. And, so it was really just at a point where the kind of the family and life balance just got to a point where we just couldn't do both.
And so obviously I've kind of gotten to know you through the interview process here at LeadMD and in the resulting weeks since you've come on and so on. But I'd say the area of your kind of path that I'm least familiar with is kind of, the jump from Accenture and the restaurant business and so on into Copart. So tell me a little bit about how that came about and how you even found out about Copart.
Well, I think that what happened is that when I was having a very successful career at Accenture. I think by the time I left, it was 12 years total. But what had happened was, again, these kids came. And, you know, there's nothing like a mother-in-law kind of giving you one of those, you know, when is it time for you to get off the road and kind of help raise these kids? And it was just kind of that comment that she said to me where I was like, wow, I guess I never even thought about it. And I had three children under 2 years old. They were very, very close. You know, when it was 16 minutes and 16 months apart. So that just little kick in my butt was one of those things where I just put some word out on the street that I was ready to look for a job. And I had a pretty good reputation in the industry for building big systems. And so a recruiter friend of mine came to me and said, if you really want to do this, I got the company for you. And for a CIO position with a company that just wants to grow like crazy. And so this was Copart, which at the time was about $50 million in sales. And they wanted me to build a department. And they said, just fire everybody you got and start from the ground up. And we want to build basically our enterprise system from scratch, because we have such a different business than anything you can get in a package. And I was known as a builder and someone who had no problem building from scratch. And so I started my career at Copart, and that it just started just like that. And it was one of those things where they understood that I was going to take my kids to daycare in the morning and get to work at 9 o'clock. It was, but I would never be late. And we picked a date for us to get the system launched about a year after I started. It was actually a year and a month. And I had promised February 1st, 2000, no, what is it, 1996 or something, 1997. And we went live that day. So it was one of those things that just started out very, very successfully at Copart. And I was, you know, I was lucky enough to build enough systems there to even get a patent on some products that I built there for auction systems. And we went from $50 million in sales to well over $1 billion while I was there.
Wow.
And the market cap of that company went from about $120 million to, I think when I left, it was about $4.5 billion. And now it's close to $8 billion company. And I'm proud to say they're still using the systems I built. So it was a great ride. It was just something that just kind of was a perfect fit at the perfect time.
That's awesome. So, and so what's the time span around your time with Copart?
So I was there for 15 years.
Wow.
And from 1996 to 2011.
You don't run into many of those 15 year stories anymore.
No. And the reason I left was, again, the family. What happened is in California, there was a big election between Meg Whitman and Jerry Brown. And these guys were pretty much Republicans all the way. And I remember the CEO, who is still one of my great friends, Jay Adair, said to me, if Meg Whitman loses, we're moving to Texas where there's no state income tax. And this is a California boy. And I'm like, no way, you won't do that. And I'll be dang, you know, a week after Meg lost, and she lost by a lot, he sold our building and said, we're all moving to Texas. And I had my three girls still in high school. And it had been a great run, and we had made some pretty good money. And I just said, well, I'm not moving to Texas. It was just one of those things where I just could not move my girls from Northern California and went a really good school that I wanted them to go to almost my entire life, to Dallas, Texas. And so, we had to part ways, and otherwise I'd probably still be working there today. We still have a very close relationship now.
So you mentioned that you had kind of developed some patents there during your time at Copart. And what I think is super interesting is kind of your next move. So tell us a little bit about what Snapsheet is and kind of what, you know, obviously the move of Copart prompted you to take that role, but just kind of how these things align, because it seems very much kind of in line with some of the work you had done previously.
Yeah. Well, Copart is a auction business, but it was really for the insurance services industry. I mean, it was selling wrecked cars. Copart is the largest seller of totaled vehicles in the United States. And so I was very friendly with a lot of insurance companies and knew a lot about the insurance business and got very deep in the insurance business as well. My patents is actually in auction systems, but I really knew a lot about insurance. And you know, the deal was is that Jay, the people I was leaving at Copart just really didn't want me working for another insurance-based company for 2 years. You know, we call it a non-compete, but they took very good care of me. And so I had to stay out of the insurance business per se for 2 years. And literally the day my 2 years was up, I said to my wife, who turned out to be also not only a great restaurateur, but a great recruiter. I said, "Hey, Sarah, I need a job." And so she went in, and because my patent was in bidding, she put in the word bids and claims in Google, and a article on a company called Body Shop Bids came up. And Body Shop Bids is the DBA for what turned out to be Snapsheet. And she just sent my resume off to Brad Weisberg, who was the who still is the CEO of Snapsheet. And the next day he called me up and he said, "Are you really the ex-CIO of Copart?" And I said, "Yes, who are you?" And he said, "Well, you guys sent my resume, you know." And I'm like, "What?" And so I kind of go, "Sherry, who's these people?" She goes, "Oh, they're in Michigan," because it turned out the article was in Michigan Avenue magazine.
Okay.
And she thought Michigan Avenue must be in Michigan.
Right.
But it turns out it's in Chicago. We don't know. We didn't know anything about Chicago. And so they talked to me and they said, "Why, you know, we're doing about $3,000 a year in sales, and $3,000 a month in sales. And there's only six of us here. What are you thinking?" And I'm like, "I don't know. What do you do?" And they told me about their process, which is all about not showing up, which is what my auction product was all about. Showing up is a very expensive concept. To have someone show up somewhere means that you need to have, you know, a building, you need to have people, you probably need to have food, you need to have all kinds of things. And so in the auction product that I created, we removed the idea of someone having to show up to an auction because they could do it all on the internet. And what Brad had done is he had designed a product so that people didn't have to show up to get an estimate on their car. They were beginning to develop an app, a mobile app at the time, to try to send it to people so that they could take pictures of their damage and then have the estimate for that damage written in a kind of centralized way. And so they were trying to figure that concept out and trying to work with insurance companies, and they were trying to get a little more legitimate. And when I came along, and they just kind of needed somebody to really think through the process. They had a great idea, but they needed some of the kind of execution pieces of that, you know, even understanding that you needed to collect and build your systems based on claim numbers and just some of the very basics of insurance and how, what the insurance process has to be. And so they asked me to come out and visit them. And I think I talked to them on a Thursday, and I flew it on a Monday. I'd never even been to Chicago except for the airport before. Coming from the Bay Area, New York, you don't really stop in Chicago. And so I went, I met these guys, and I really fell in love with not only their product, but these Brad and CJ, the two real founders of the company. And the three of us just got along famously from the start, and they were willing to listen, and they started changing their product. And they asked me to come on at first as an advisor. And then, they invited me to some kind of offsite event in Aspen and got me really drunk and said, "How can we get you to come on and build our company with us and help us raise money?" And which is also what they needed to do. They needed to raise some money. Mm-hmm. And it just was a really good match. And my kids were just starting college, which was part of the reason I couldn't move to Dallas. And so all my kids were getting out of home anyway. And so the timing was just perfect. And so I moved to Chicago, and it was just one of those things where it's like, "All right, let's try this out. I've never done a startup." And frankly, it helps when it wasn't like one of these things where if it didn't work out, I was in a lot of trouble. It was, I'd always wanted to try to do something from scratch like this and be not only just a technology guy, but to be the people guy, because it was one of my strengths at Copart. I'd built a department of 230 people at Copart, so I really knew how to build departments and businesses. And so, and that's what we did. And I was employee 7, and my wife actually then came on to be our recruiter, our chief talent officer. In fact, to this day, as of this day, she is still an employee of Copart as their chief talent officer, but that's going away in about a week. We grew that business. So I was like, she was 6 or 7, and I was 7 and she was 8. I think there's now 425 people at the company. We went from 3,000 a month to well over 2 million a month in sales.
Huge amount.
And the company has just gone like gangbusters. And so we have, so if you see any commercials on TV for like Liberty Mutual or USA bragging about their mobile app, that's really a white label product that we created.
And that is really their business model, right? Like they are empowering existing insurance organizations to as you said, not
show
up to that
claim. That's right. No, insurance companies are great at marketing, but building technology has never been something that they've been strong at least from my perspective. And so to be able to outsource something like a mobile app and to actually provide, you know, be the business process outsource the BPO for that one business and understanding all the processes that need to happen to make sure that their customers feel taken care of as if you are them, is what we did. So we built a complete process. We were kind of the vendor of record for that. We were really a partner. And so when we answered the phone, as USAA or Liberty Mutual.
Right.
And we're able to really service their clients in a white label fashion and make them proud. We were actually their quickest channel. What normally took 2 weeks, we did in 3 hours. And we could settle in one day 30% of the time by just paying them overnight right through the app. So it was a very, very successful new channel for insurance companies to get some of their customers who just wanted a cash out done. And if they did want to get the repair done, then we managed the entire repair process and made sure that everybody was happy.
Yeah,
so very high net promoter scores. And
customer service on demand.
It truly was. Yes, it really was. Absolutely.
And now we've stolen you away from frigid Chicago out to sunny Arizona to work on this little project.
Well, you know, it was one of those things that I said, look, while my kids are in school, I'll be so happy to do this. But once my kids got out of school, I just can't see myself staying in Chicago. I love Chicago. But at the time, I didn't know I was going to fall so in love with Chicago. And so we worked out a 4-year deal. And probably within the first year, we started looking in Scottsdale because that was the place we knew we wanted to go next. And so we started looking for homes in Scottsdale probably the first year in Chicago. And we came here every summer for 3-4 summers in a row, just this last summer buying a home. And so we knew we were going to end up in Scottsdale. And so this again was one of those things where as it was beginning to wind down, it was, you know, okay, Sherry, help me find a place.
Yeah. Totally.
And she found you. So that's why I'm here, buddy. She found you and said, oh, this is another good match for you. Why don't you send, you know, put in a call to these guys. And literally that's how it happened. I didn't find Copart. I didn't find you. Sherry found both. I mean, Snapsheet or you. So
yeah. It sounds like Sherry. A lot of companies owe a lot to Sherry along this string of
we all owe a lot to Sherry. That's kind of how it works with me. If anything I'm in, you know, she's been my partner for life. She's been an incredible partner and a very, very talented individual.
That's awesome. So normally I'm talking to folks on the show about like their latest venture and so on, but I'm completely reversing that for this podcast. So what I'd really like to understand more about is, you know, you've almost lived several different lives in each one. You're like, this is a lot of successful ventures in a lot of different areas. And I'm curious how you kind of keep your leadership skills fresh. How do you respond to trends? Is that important at all? I'm just curious as to how you kind of maintained a consistency and also a relevancy throughout that entire process.
You know, I really do believe in keeping myself educated, and I read a lot. It's actually one of the things that came here when I came here. I wanted to. People ask me what kinds of things I read, and you know, the Crucial Conversations book, The Happiness Advantage, The Art of Scaling, are three of my favorite books. And that I base a lot of what I do on, what a lot of my approach on. I've read probably, you know, 5 or 6 leadership books over the last probably 3-4 years, just to kind of find out what other people are doing. And you know, there's always people who have ideas or approaches that you may not have thought about. And like the Happiness Advantage points out, you know, success comes from happiness. I don't think happiness comes from success. And so it's really about trying to understand what makes people happy in their jobs and what makes people want to come to work every day. And like I said at the beginning, I think, you know, people who like to work on things they like to work on, and people will get better at things that they love to do. You know, you'll always see a person who plays music and loves it will be playing in the mall on the weekend for free just because they love the mastery of of learning their craft. And so I really try to give people the opportunity to work more on what they love to do and to give them a break on the things they don't love to do, because they're probably not going to get that much better at it. And so I think just kind of focusing on that is what I've been doing.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite concepts. I mean, people do what they want to do ultimately. Like when you're talking to someone, they're like, oh, I wish I had time to do X, Y, and Z. If you really wanted to do that, you would find time for it. You know, like we all find a level watermark at some point, and that for me, that always tends to be around things that you really, really enjoy doing, like what you make time for in your life and so on.
I agree. And this is just one of those things that I love to do. So I'm lucky enough that I get to do what I love to do.
Absolutely. So mentors along the way, anyone stand out as like the, you know, a pivotal figure?
Well, you know, it's one of those things that I you know, the founder of Copart's name, a guy named Willis Johnson. And he was just one of those people that just really told me to, you know, to trust my gut. He was not a paralysis analysis guy. He kind of told me, as he told almost all of the executives, that he was paying for the person and for the gut, and to so that making decisions on gut versus data is not such a popular thing to do. But he told me to trust my gut, and if something didn't feel right, to bring it up and not be afraid to bring it up. So I think Willis Johnson was probably one of my bigger mentors, and obviously a very successful man at Copart. And I think that, you know, I was lucky enough to be a Boy Scout, an Eagle Scout. And there was a gentleman named Bob Turner who trusted me and taught me really leadership in Scouts and how to say you're wrong and not be afraid to say when you've made a mistake and to stand tall, but to come to grips with that everybody makes mistakes and to give people a break and to let people off the hook. And so, you know, Bob Turner and probably Willis Johnson are two of those people that just really come to mind when I think of mentors.
So when I hear you talk about that, it's interesting because, you know, my previous question of, you know, how do you keep leadership skills fresh and so on? Like, it's kind of the same consistent themes though, right? You know what I mean? Like nowadays with startup environments, it's so popular to fail fast and failures are great. You know, what did you learn from that and so on? But it's kind of the same thing that it's the same fundamental that you're talking about there in terms of, you know, admit you're wrong when you're wrong, learn something from it, move on quickly. I feel like a lot of that advice has become super trendy now to attach with the startup world, but it has existed for a really long time.
Well, I think what happened in the startup world, and I think that what I was able to bring, because I was a little more of a senior member of the team by a few years, and somewhat similar to here. And I think that what I did is I gave people permission to be human. And lots of times when people are just starting out their career, it's very competitive. It's very testosterone based almost. And it doesn't allow people to just reflect and step back. And so by giving people permission to be themselves which is what Willis gave me, you know, Willis said to me, look, we're all going to be eating steak. Don't worry about it. You know, let's just do the right thing for our people and let's, you know, stand tall and stand behind, our people. And if we make mistakes, then, you know, go out there. You don't have anything to prove. You already got the title. You know, I was the chief information officer. I didn't need to convince anybody or hit anybody in the head with it. So I think what it's allowed me to do is to be able to give people some permission to be human and to, even if they make a mistake, say, hey, what did we learn? You know, we've already made it. Willis used to say all the time, well, if we already made the mistake, let's see what we can learn from it so we can at least get something out of it.
Absolutely.
And so I think that's what it's allowed me to do in the startup world, because just like at Snapsheet, I think when people are first starting out, they're so afraid to fail. And I kind of gave permission, you know, for people to be able to speak their mind.
And so the other big topic that we hear about, you know, failure is a huge topic in startups and, you know, just this hyper speed way of life. But the other topic that we're always talking about is scale. And I think with the perspective that you've got from all these different organizations starting off very early on and seeing that radical success, Is there a consistency? Is there a magic ingredient in terms of scale?
You know, as my boss, Justin, I have to tell you the one consistent thing in all my success was me. So there you go. But no, I'm just kidding. But I think what I learned at Accenture was structure is needed. Things are not going to scale, just like in construction. You're not going to be able to actually scale a building without having a really good foundation and without having the right kind of structure to lay things on top of. And so I have a tendency to build at the top and then build underneath and then build up and then build underneath. And so that kind of constant looking for leadership to bring people up to the next level so that they can then have some confidence to bring people in underneath them and constantly growing that way has worked very well for me. So when I, to get to 230 people at Copart over 15 years, it wasn't overnight, but I took, you know, 16 people and made them directors when they had never been directors in their life. And I took a couple of people who had never been VPs who kind of were cream that rose to the top and made them VPs. And so when you give people a career path and you let them know that there's places for them to go, then I think people who want to rise, like you said, who want to get better, will rise to the occasion. And then you can put others underneath. And I made sure that those leaders had the confidence that when new people came in, that they weren't afraid to hire people who were better than them, who could help them grow. And so having that confidence in them allowed them to bring in good people and not feel like they needed to bring in weaker people. And so they could build some beautiful organizations underneath themselves and just deliver in such a great way. And then when those people, you know, created other leaders out of the people they brought up, that made them feel fantastic. And so seeing some of my people, you know, one of my people who worked for me became the CIO at Del Monte, and that was just a fantastic thing. Another one became the CIO at the San Francisco Giants, and another one became a CIO at StubHub. And so having those people who worked for me to go into those roles and be able to come back and thank me for helping them get there was one of the thrills of my life.
Yeah, I love the construction analogy always because, you know, I truly believe things scale naturally. They just don't scale in the direction that you want them to. They don't, you know, failure is going to become amplified pretty quickly if you're going in the wrong direction. And so that's key to have that foundation, as you talked about. So you brought up my last and my favorite topic, quite frankly, which is, what do you look for? You know, you mentioned you kind of taking those high performers and putting them into critical positions, but what do you look for when you're hiring someone? Because that's so key. You know, if you don't have the right people in the seats, you can't put the gas to the floor board and hit the accelerator, right? So what do you look for when you're hiring someone that really tells you this is someone I can build a business around?
Well, I am looking for people who can be honest with themselves and who may not always just believe their own narrative and are open to understanding what they've done well and where they want to grow. Obviously, I'm almost always looking for a pretty good pedigree, to be honest. I have a tendency to try to trust the background that they have. And so if they've done well in their past, I usually will start there. Taking people straight off the street, I had to do it at Snapsheet because it was a business of estimators and, you know, no one grows up to want to being an estimator. It's usually a DUI or a missing a test or something. And there's no job. And there's that farmer's guy sitting on campus going, come on, you got nowhere else to go. And so that was a lot of heart. And that was a lot of people saying, man, just give me a shot. You know, let me just work my butt off. But I think in most of my career, it has been people with some pretty decent pedigrees that can talk and reflect about the things that they did well and the things that they didn't do so well and that where they wanted to grow. And people who feel like they have all the answers are not really people I want to work with, I guess, because it's hard to break that shell.
Totally.
But I think that people who can be very open on the things that they really love to do and they have a good history of doing that, I'll bet on.
Yeah, I can definitely vouch for the, I gravitate towards those folks, that heart individual so naturally. And quite honestly, that was at the root of a lot of early mistakes that I made in my career from a hiring perspective is, you know, looking at someone that says, hey, just give me that shot. And heart will take you, you know, a little bit down the road, but you're right. You have to have those critical skill sets, or when you're truly looking to build and scale a business, suddenly that lack of experience and skill set really starts to rear its head in a really negative way. So it's always obviously about the combination of those two, but skilled individuals are just so critical to any good business.
You really have to invest in that. And sometimes you have to pay a little more money to do that. But, you know, Willis, again, was one of those people that said, look, I would rather pay for somebody than, you know, if I got the wrong person, it's going to cost me 5 years. And that's not good for them. And it's not good for the company. And I don't believe in stunting people's growth by putting them in the wrong spot with the wrong manager and then that person never really living up to their potential. I just feel like you do need to have a certain amount of skill to do a job. You have to have the experience so that we're not kind of explaining some of the basics. And then you got to, you know, let's see them grow. Let's see autonomy and mastery is really how what I'm looking for in someone. And if they don't have, they're not used to autonomy and they have no mastery, it's going to be very difficult for me to grow them.
Great way to for us to wrap up here. David, I really appreciate you sharing your story with us here today. It's so diverse, and I feel like there's some great nuggets in there that everyone could take away from it. If folks want to connect with you after the podcast, where should they go?
Well, I guess they should probably go right to my LinkedIn. I think that's something that we know we're going to be updating here real soon, and so that's probably the best way. If they want to connect with me, that would be the best way to do it.
Awesome.
So, well, you know, David Bauer at LinkedIn.
Awesome. So, David, again, thanks for joining us here today. Appreciate everyone tuning in. And, of course, if you want to check out past episodes, you can always do so at leadmd.com/marketplace. And as a closing remark, as always, I'd invite you to trust in the unconventional.
Thanks for listening to the Driven & Co. podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's episode. To hear more, visit leadmd.com/marketplace.